Welcome back, everyone, to another day, another week here at the Damage Report. Not just any day, though, a fantastic Monday. Although, let's keep it real. I don't think it's gonna be that fantastic. Even with, we have Francesca. I mean, we have that. Hey, Francesca, how's it going? Francesca Fiorentini. Like, are you gonna go on record and say that this is getting off to a fantastic beginning of the week?
There's nothing wrong in the world today, okay? You thought there was, but I'm here to tell you there's not. Don't even look at your phone. Don't even look at it. Just stay on this show. You. There's everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
As we sip our coffee in flames.
Yes. Yeah. Well, last week, look, near the end of last week, there wasn't a lot going on. And I foolishly wished that there would be more news. And it's not going well, though. But we do want to thank you for being here, for facing the news as we have day after day throughout this, the first season of the Damage Report. Anyway, we're glad to have you here. We will be talking in just a short while about the devastating situation in Afghanistan. And it's, look, it's going to be rough. Let's keep it real. It just is. We're going to try to lighten things a little bit later on by talking about some of the worst takes on it. And I've tried to be choosy because there are so many that are absolute garbage. But the rough news continues afterward. Hades in the aftermath of a devastating earthquake. AOC has responded to the incredibly misogynistic, hateful comments of Tucker Carlson. And then you get into kids in hospital for COVID. So yeah, it's gonna be a rough one. But thank you for being here. Hope that you hit the like button and share the stream so that others can suffer with us. And as we go through all of this, if you would want to send us any messages, comments, tweets, anything like that, super chats, we'll be responding as we go. Oh, early heads up. This will lighten up things a little bit. So with everything that's going on in Afghanistan, obviously, I've been thinking back to, you know, it's been 20 years. And so we had a suggestion for a top 10 list, which we do every Monday, Francesca and myself. And we're gonna be talking about school, what we missed from way back in the before times, not just before the pandemic, before all of this. So that'll be going up for our tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube later on if you'd like to become one. But with that said, Francesca, how'd you like to talk about the news?
Sure. I mean, is that what you do on this show?
Sometimes.
Oh, cool. So I've never been here, but anyway.
Sometimes we just talk about Quentin Tarantino's family problems. Sometimes.
Please. I feel like the news out of Afghanistan is less upsetting somehow than that.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Quote from him. Anyway, okay. I've stalled as long as I can. Let's do this. The situation in Afghanistan is devastating, as I am sure you are quite aware. And with every passing hour, it seems to be getting worse. Most recently, right as we're going live, we found out about more violence near the airport in Kabul. Originally, 2 men had been shot, now more have been. But let's catch up a little bit. So the morning after the Taliban installed themselves in the presidential palace in Kabul, Afghan officials in other cities were filmed handing over power to insurgent leaders. President Ashraf Ghani fled the country as the insurgents entered the city just yesterday. The former president, Hamid Karzai, said he had formed a council with other political leaders to coordinate a peaceful transition to a new Taliban government. And the head of the Presidential Protective Service, which has guarded it for most of the last 2 decades, shook hands with the Taliban commander and announced the handover. And so, of course, look, there's been a lot of, you know, horrible, now instantly iconic imagery. Leaders of the Taliban at the presidential desk being one. We will talk about others. You know, Kabul's international airport is under the protection of foreign forces. That deployment is increasing. Thousands of US soldiers have been sent to the country to assist it in what is described as a hasty evacuation, which those words are doing a lot of work there. Thousands of Afghanis flooded the tarmac on Monday morning, at one point swarming a departing US military plane. And there is horrible imagery, videos of people falling from the plane to their deaths as it took off. So yeah, it is worse, I guess, than most of those involved in the military presence of the US had expected it to be, at least instantly. But by any measure, it is horrible what is happening there right now. Francesca, let's get into it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that as you know, obviously you can't look at these images and not immediately feel for the Afghan people who've lived under Taliban rule before, lived under that, you know, sort of iron fist before, were promised a pack of lies and got nothing but occupation and a country that was ravaged and used as a breeding ground for weapons contractors and others to make a killing, right? Literally, figuratively, whatever. You've got a rise of opium production, a drug trade that was not existent in terms of at least not as robust before the Americans came. And now you've got a country that is back in the hands of the Taliban. So just on understanding how devastating that must be, and to the point where people are clinging to aircraft carriers, to airplanes to try and get out of Kabul. Number one, my immediate reaction is the US must make right by the people that helped its occupation, who live in Afghanistan, translators, you know, assistants, helpers, whomever, like parts of the Afghan government itself, right? And this is not just on the United States, it's on NATO, right? We're talking about many, many countries that need to open their borders to Afghan refugees and asylum seekers, of which there are hundreds of thousands. That needs to happen. It might not happen right now immediately, but it needs to happen in short order.
Yeah, and we're gonna have a little bit of information about some of what some countries are doing in preparation for, you know, getting people out of the country. In terms of the fears about what the Taliban will do, they are putting on a bit of like a PR offensive to reassure the people of the country they are reconquering and now have basically complete control over, that they shouldn't worry. They've issued statements aimed at reassuring Afghans. They say there will be no revenge attacks on those who worked for the government or its security services, and that life, property, and honor will be respected. They're urging Afghans to remain in the country and have pledged to create a secure environment for businesses, embassies, and foreign and local charities. That is what they are saying. Last month, though, after capturing the Malistan district of the southern Ghazni province, Taliban fighters went door to door looking for people who had worked with the government, killing at least 27 civilians, wounding 10 others, and looting homes. And now that's like sort of the directly going for people who were a part of the regime. They say they're not going to do that. Sure. In terms of the broader effect that they're going to have, they've given no strong indication that this will be anything other than the way the Taliban ruled in the period they did, the half decade they did before, you know, 2001. And I think people are expecting that. In the center of Kabul, people began painting over advertisements and posters of women at beauty salons, already fearing the return of the Taliban's traditional bans against images of humans and against women appearing in public unveiled. Word on the streets of Kabul today say there are far fewer women actually in public. Those that are there are dressed far more conservatively. Men who have been interviewed have changed out of their more Western modern wear for outfits that are considered more acceptable by the Taliban. So I understand every single, well, I mean, I don't fully understand every one of those fears. I haven't lived through it. I've had that privilege, but I try to understand those fears. I can't imagine what, like you mentioned, Francesca, you know, that there are people there that of course remember how horrific it was under the Taliban. There are others that don't. They've lived their whole life in this period. Obviously, the Taliban has existed. There has been endless violence and terror attacks. There's been all of that, but they haven't been under the direct control for the most part. So they must feel like a different kind of terror about what it could mean, because they don't have that experience that they can draw upon.
There's a lot of things to say about how and why the US backed Afghan military and government crumbled so quickly. I think it was very surprising to a lot of people, and yet unsurprising if you've been paying attention to how poorly the war in Afghanistan is going and has been going. How much disinformation, how much lack of information, how much faulty intelligence, that generals didn't know what they were doing, and that ultimately after 20 years, the United States was unable to build a government that instilled any amount of support from the people. And yes, it is hard to imagine that the Taliban might enjoy in some instances broader support, but you have to remember the Taliban have one thing going for them, albeit their brutal tactics aside, they're from Afghanistan. So that does count for something, whereas the United States, not from Afghanistan, after 20 years of funneling endless amounts of money, a lot of it embezzled and, you know, in corrupt ways disappeared, still they were unable to mount a moral political force that actually had political traction and legitimacy, right? Mm-hmm. And so I want to remember that. The second thing I want to say is that I'm sure that things will get worse under the Taliban, but it is interesting and notable that very few people have died up until this point. That say what you will, Biden should have stayed longer, Biden should have had a different withdrawal plan. There are not, I mean, other than people who are like clinging to planes, right? The Taliban have not engaged in firefights with US military personnel, right? With the Afghan military. Like, people have not died en masse. Like, that's not what's happening right now.
So I'm sure it's possible that, I mean, tactically, shooting at the US troops as they leave seems like one of the best ways to get, you know, neocons and, you know, libs are supportive of endless military wars to come back in.
Sure.
So and it is look, possible that they could change, you
it
know,
could absolutely change. It could change. I'm just saying I'm not giving any kind of moral judgment of that. I'm just astounded that actually this has been fairly bloodless. That's not to say it won't get worse. The other thing to note is that the Taliban, as gross as it might appear, they are trying to kind of be a real political force. They've got like, you know, an embassy in like Doha, Qatar. They're like, they started peace talks with Trump. They say, this was another statement they made before they assumed power most recently, that there will be a role for women in government as there was under the, you know, under the US backed Afghan regime. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Is this the new Taliban? And I think ultimately, what is the United States' role? And is it to play global cop, global police? Are we supposed to go around installing, you know, governments and toppling dictators wherever we see fit just cause we're into nation building? Oh, no, wait, this is for 9/11. Oh, no, wait, it was unclear from the beginning.
Yeah, well, look, I think those are sort of separate things. Obviously, I'm not supportive of an endless military deployment there. You know, been consistent on that from way back in, you know, the run up to the war. I remember that, and I'm sure you'll be talking about your experience there too. That said, I have as little information about the past, let alone the present or future course of the Taliban, as virtually anyone does. That said, that hasn't stopped anyone else from opining on it over the past 24 hours or so. I don't expect massive change. We'll see. We'll see. I have very little expectations there. But you know, who knows? I would love to be surprised there. I've been surprised often in the past year or two in politics, almost always in a negative direction. Yeah.
The real question, John, isn't like whether or not, you know, whether or not they're gonna be good, they're gonna be bad. It is how can the United States make whole the people that it has, you know, left behind and the people.
Sure, we're gonna turn to that in a minute.
So
yes, we're going to turn to that. I just want to point out, and you mentioned this too. So in terms of like money that's been spent, they say $83 billion has been spent directly on creating the security force. Who knows if that's the total amount? And obviously, as you pointed out, there was a massive amount of corruption where the money got sent there and then God only knows what happened with it. Seems fair though. I mean, you know, here our defense contractors were making huge amounts of money off of it. So why shouldn't they, I guess? Estimates of how much the war itself have cost over the past couple of decades vary broadly. But a number I've seen come up very often is at least $2 trillion specifically in Afghanistan. $2 trillion. By the way, that $83 billion for the security force, they say it would cost $25 billion to vaccinate the world. So to put it in perspective, yeah, devastating. 2,400 American soldiers died. Or service members died in Afghanistan, thousands more were wounded, at least tens of thousands of civilians have died. That seems like a massive undercount there, and God only knows. But the cost in dollars and in lives has been absolutely devastating. Hopefully it will continue, as you are pointing out, as somewhat bloodless right now, but that remains to be seen. You want to turn to getting people out of there? Okay, let's do it. So the task now seems to be Biden talking about sending soldiers temporarily to Afghanistan. We will see what temporarily turns out to be in this context. Others are saying we now need to do a far better job than clearly has been done over the past day or so of getting people out of there, both those who are actually at the airport trying to leave and those who are potentially going to be targeted for either their service to the Afghan government, to the US soldiers there, or people who are in a variety of classes that simply might be targeted, female academics, people involved in NGOs, a number of different groups like that. And so the US government has said in the coming days it would evacuate thousands of American citizens, embassy employees and their families, and quote, particularly vulnerable Afghan nationals. So does that mean translators? Is it broader than that? If so, how much broader? We don't necessarily know. But five Mediterranean countries on the forefront of past mass migration to Europe, Cyprus, Greece, Italy, Malta, and Spain, have requested European Union level talks on Wednesday about how to respond. There are also concerns about refugees flowing to Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey. And Canada said last week that it would resettle more than 20,000 Afghan citizens from groups it considers likely targets of the Taliban, including leading women, rights workers, and LGBTQ people. So I am assuming we're going to see a lot more out of that. And I should also let you know that in about 2 hours or so, Biden is supposed to be speaking. We will see what direction he goes, or both, sending soldiers back in or getting people out of Afghanistan. So far, from what you're seeing, Francesca, how satisfied are you with the resettlement effort?
I mean, it is a start. It's good that talks may be starting to happen. I think it needs to continue to happen. And I think that President Biden should take leadership on this and should, you know, use it as a point to turn around some of his kind of honestly disappointing immigration policies and say that, especially when it comes to Afghanistan, we have a moral responsibility to allow refugees to resettle and asylum seekers to live in the United States. And there's other things obviously the United States can do to make sure that Afghanistan, you know, in terms of if the Taliban can be circumvented, to support on the ground organizations. I support that. I definitely support people doing that. You know, I don't always trust where the United States government puts its funds, clearly. But I think, you know, I think people to people and that kind of stuff, look, we live in a globalized, you know, digitized world. We can do those kinds of things. I don't know if we're going to, I think we're going to talk about the political stuff later. I am very curious as to what Joe Biden is going to say, and I do have a lot of thoughts about it.
Yeah, I can only imagine who has been advising him and who has been trying to advise him. I mean, we've seen like some of the rogues gallery of people who got us into Afghanistan, many of them still working in media. They've learned a lot, I would guess. They don't seem to have. Still writing about it, op-eds. What does David Frum think, Francesca, about the war in Afghanistan? So we'll see. I mean, I don't know. Is he going to send 10,000 soldiers that are going to be there for the next 5 years? Is it going to become 20,000? I don't know. Like, they seem dead set on getting out, but Biden has responded negatively to crises like, you know, more people coming across the southern border in ways that hardly seemed consistent with what he had said he was going to do. But also, like, we're talking about, you know, our fears of how these different groups could potentially be affected. You know, I mean, the Taliban is a group that had a very liberal idea of how often capital punishment should be used and how brutally it should be used. And now all of these people could potentially be at risk. But I also see some people expressing sort of similar opinions, and I fear that it is a cover for wanting to, you know, continue the endless occupation in the same way that those sorts of concerns were trotted out about Iraq, you know, before the war in Iraq as well. So I like to see more empathy on display in American political discourse, but sometimes I worry when foreign policy is the battleground. Empathy often seems like just another tool for them to use to give the defense contractors and the, you know, the warmongers what they want. So
That, yeah, no, it is. That is exactly what it was. You know, 20 years ago, it wasn't just 9/11. It moved to, well, we must have empathy for the Afghan women and the children and the people. And, you know, we need to free a nation. And it was like, okay, I guess we're doing that now. All right, what about the terrorists? It's like, no, okay. You know, so that is what the war in Afghanistan quickly became. That's what the occupation became. And so Americans have had our empathy weaponized and propagandized against us in order to continue the occupation of Afghanistan, to promise that a new nation is, oh, it's on the horizon. It is coming. It is gonna get here, and man, it's gonna be good. And okay, we were promised that once we leave, that new nation would be able to stand on its own two feet. Well, guess what? It took weeks. It took a day for Kabul to fall. So what were we actually doing in Afghanistan? We were lining the pockets of weapons contractors and others, many, many others, not to mention propping up warlords who, may I remind you, not necessarily better than the Taliban. Let's just keep it 100 here about all that. And in the meantime, the media saying how bad it is going. Oh, it's so bad in Kabul, it's so bad. It's been bad. Soldiers have been at risk. Soldiers have been dying. Civilians have been displaced and dying. But you weren't covering it 2 weeks ago. You weren't covering it 4 weeks ago. You weren't covering it 18, like you were not covering it so long as it maintained a status quo of a just awfulness, right? Yeah. Like that no one was covering it, but now, oh, now we want to talk about it. And now we care once again. So I am so sick and tired of having my empathy for the Afghan people be used in order to further a US imperial occupation of another country. All right, we need to end that. We need to understand what real solidarity and real empathy looks like. And it has nothing to do with a continuance of US military involvement in the Middle East.
Let me ask you a question to what you were just saying about the media. Obviously, you know, I mean, some of our viewers are young enough that they probably don't remember, but we know what the media was like in the run up to the, you know, the wars 20 years ago. And right now, the media isn't doing too well ratings wise. And, you know, Biden in theory would kind of like to have something maybe in a, you know, hypothetical sense dominating the news that isn't about his lack of ability to get anything passed. I have no idea whether these are true of any individuals or groups or whatever. This is just mere speculation, but these are the sorts of conditions that produce, you know, pushes for continued war and stuff like that. Are you worried that we could see a sharp swing in the political media and the Biden administration?
Honestly, not really. I mean, we'll see what Biden says today, but hearing, you know, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken speak on this, get pushed on this by, you know, by mainstream media, and sticking to his guns about the fact that we needed to leave, almost makes me respect the Biden administration in a way that I haven't before. Like respecting the fact that there was no good way out of this war. There's no good way out of a bad war. That's just, that is, period. And so in order to cut your losses after 20 years and fully embrace, like, look, this is how it had to be done. What is the other option? Slowly maintaining smaller and smaller amounts of American forces. What happens then? American forces are surrounded. They are without support. You risk more firefights. You risk more lives. Was that the way to go? What if the headlines were, oh, 100 American forces surrounded by 500 Taliban get murdered in a town square. Oh, that's a great headline, right? Yeah. Like that is obviously. So I'm almost proud of Biden saying, we are dismantling, we are taking apart this American imperial venture known as the war on terror. It's done. Now, of course, they're not gonna say they failed, quote unquote, which by the way, we know that there was no success wasn't even delineated. So what the hell was that supposed to look like? But this is as good, I think, as it gets when it comes to really trying to turn a corner when it comes to what the US military's role is in the world.
Yeah. And like, you know, those who I guess were against withdrawal, you know, when it was announced a year ago or whatever, or, you know, the multiple times it was announced over the last 10 years. might say now, well, look, you know, it's going horribly. Well, like, who didn't think? What serious person didn't think that there would be really bad ramifications? Sometimes all paths suck. That's the way it sometimes goes. You know, and there's a bunch of people that were advocating for this to have been done years ago or never to have been initiated in the first place. There's a lot of erasure of alternative paths that we didn't go down as a country. Anyway, in terms of the narrative around blame, we are gonna have a little bit more on that. I wanna take our first break though, get a few of your thoughts from out there in the audience. We're gonna return to some more of the political implications in anticipation of Biden's address. So we'll be back in just a few. With that, let's jump to a very different angle on this. We're expecting, as we're filming this, that President Biden will be speaking very shortly about what's going on in Afghanistan. But even before he decided to speak, the accusations were flowing. Everybody's pointing fingers at everyone. Nobody wants to acknowledge that the war was fundamentally wrong in a number of different ways, and that was clear more than two decades ago. So for instance, a former President Donald Trump called on Biden to resign in disgrace amid the Afghanistan withdrawal. This doesn't matter. I acknowledge that before saying it, but I want to play just a little bit of his speech from 1 month ago where he was talking about the withdrawal. Take a look at this.
Started the process. All the troops are coming back home. They couldn't stop the press. 21 years is enough, don't we think? 21 years. They couldn't stop the process. They wanted to, but it was very tough to stop the process when other things are at. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's a shame. 21 years by a government that wouldn't last. The only way they last is if we're there. What are we going to say? We'll stay for another 21 years, then we'll stay for another 50. The whole thing is ridiculous. So we're bringing our troops back home.
Okay, so like I know that everybody's going to claim that they were right or whatever. But he was saying a month ago, they're only there as long as we're there. We gotta go. Biden is trying to keep us there. He's wrong to keep us there. He should be leaving. So they're leaving, and yeah, this is what you said this was gonna happen. So why are you saying that he should resign? But it's not just him. I mean, you go to Fox News, they have finally found something other than critical race theory to talk about. Critics blame Biden for rapid fall of Afghanistan. You can see the screenshot here. If we could bring it up, do we have that? No. Okay. Do we have the next one? It's not gonna be meaningful anymore. Anyway, okay, so then let's just dispense with the whole thing. So, Francesca, this is a war that has gone on through Biden, through Trump, through Obama, through two terms of Bush. I personally think the idea that any one person or administration is the one to blame seems at best purposefully simplistic, but I understand that that's what politics is about, that they're gonna point fingers at each other. If it was up to you,
yes,
what would the takeaway be in terms of who or what or which were to blame for what we've experienced? Not just in the past, you know, day, but in the thousands of days that this war has gone on.
That would be who is George W. Bush? F him forever and ever.
Well, why is he to blame?
Because he started the war on terror. I mean, this is the entire thing.
Yeah, that's true.
I think F George Bush, F Obama for continuing it, for thinking that this was like gonna be worthwhile to send a bunch of new troops in, you know. But the whole thing, it was fated from the beginning. And I am surprised that once Obama, by the way, killed Osama bin Laden, which Democrats really don't take credit for in the way they could, that we should have left. Done deal, and we're done. The other thing I really wanna say, and it's the only time I will give any credit to Donald Trump ever. But I remember in 2016, I was at the RNC, right? And I did a fun game where I was like, say something nice about each of these candidates. And so I had a picture of Donald Trump and I was in the DNC and I was like, say something nice. And it was before, it was all sort of a game. And one guy stops and goes, you know, and it was like, oh, his hair is kind of nice. It was all these silly things. And one guy goes, he's the first Republican to actually admit that we need to leave Afghanistan. Like, he's the first Republican to admit we need to draw down troops and leave the Middle East. Now, Trump is an unmitigated, like ferocious, bloodthirsty, like, you know, aggro liar who it wants to take all the oil in Iraq instead of leave some of it, right? He's like, why don't we don't care. These, you know, he probably thinks that Afghans are backwards and they're like subhuman. That's his rationale. But the one thing that both Republicans and Democrats actually agreed on, at least the people, not the politicians, was getting the hell out of the Middle East. And Trump stood out from the entire lineup of Republicans policy-wise because of that. And that really did speak to many people who felt like, why are we nation building abroad when our country is economically in need, right? When I can't get a job, etc. It was an understandable and honestly a rational reason for liking Trump's policies. And I know it sounds crazy that I'm saying that. And when you play that clip of Trump saying that they only survived because we're there, so why don't we get out? Like, I kind of appreciate that a politician is just being honest about what a failure and what a US-backed, you know, propped up situation Afghanistan has been. It's relieving to not have it papered over and propagandized continually. Oh, we can still win. Oh, if we just do this, more troops. And so I do think that Biden is not, he's not saying the exact same thing that Trump is, but there is an admission that he is gonna get hounded for by the right, that of course even Trump himself is hounding him over. But remember the admission that this is a failed and was never a you know, I don't know that he's not gonna admit that it was never a good war to begin with, but it was a failed project from jump. And finally, Trump was the one who set the wheels in motion for withdrawing from Afghanistan. He started talks with the Taliban. He like once claimed that he loved Baradar, who's like currently the new president. Yep. He loves the Taliban. Of course, he doesn't care at all about, you know, the people who are on the, you know, the short end of the Taliban's rule, women, children, etc. It doesn't care about that. But like, Trump actually did want to get out. So of course, any leg the right wing has to stand on is hollow right now.
Yeah, well, you don't think that he's worried about the all girls robotics team that I read about? You don't think he's worried? No, I don't think he is either. You're right. He was like being honest, I guess, about the state of Afghanistan, except that he's also lied for years about his previous support for the wars. And he's lying now about what it means that things aren't going well. Does anyone think that he'd be resigning in disgrace if the same plan that he put into effect, he was still president for? If Mike Pillow had brought him back to the White House a couple days ago, no. And Fox's stance would be totally different. And probably CNN and MSNBC's would be flipped. God knows, maybe they'll end up being super critical. We don't know exactly how the media's gonna go with this. Brian Kilmeade was saying we need to have, you know, troops there forever to make sure that there aren't like new terrorist universities. I expect talks about that, you're gonna start seeing a lot more about the future growth of, you know, Al Qaeda cells and things like that. So get ready for that. But yeah, no, your analysis is obviously and predictably accurate. Bush got us in there, but Obama was president for 8 years. Yeah. And Trump was president for 4 years. So I blame most of the senators and the representatives that were totally cool with it and just forgot that the war even existed for literally years. And members of the military leadership, certainly the defense contractors and the politicians that they've bought, members of the media that got us into the war and then effectively defended it mainly by silence for literally years. And never, there was never an accounting of the failures of the media for barely for individuals, let alone as institutions. And so of course they're gonna point fingers, they have to, so that you won't look at them. And them is basically everyone that's been in power for the past two decades, except for a few standout politicians that were against the war. You know, like, you know, people like Bernie Sanders or Barbara Lee, there's a few, obviously, there's a few members of the media that weren't supportive of it. But this is basically a massive indictment of virtually everyone who's held public power for as long as many of our viewers have been alive. And that reckoning never came. They certainly don't want it to come now. And so everyone's gonna be looking for a new narrative to point the finger at something else. to create a new development that they can then start to focus on, pretend critically. Anyway, any final thoughts on this?
It's a game of spin the bottle. You know, the bottle's got to stop at some point. You can't just keep spinning the bottle. Biden,
spin it for 20 years, I guess.
You can spin it for 20 years, and Biden has the cojones to allow the bottle to stop on him and kiss whoever is at the other end there. And it's not pretty. But I will just say, quick little plug. I do have a podcast, and I did a lot of discussion about the amount of fraud that happened in Afghanistan, in an episode called "How Was the Afghan War Not a Giant Money Laundering Operation?" but you guys should definitely listen to that, because I go over just the amount of projects that were never completed in that country. Hospitals, hotels, schools, trillions of dollars gone. Billions, billions, trillions.
Billions, at least.
Billions.
We spent trillions. Like,
we spent trillions.
Billions there. Also Tony Blair, by the way. Let's not forget. And a number of others. But by the way, you know, we didn't talk much about, but usually in the morning we talk about, at the beginning of the show, we talk about the Vituation Room. Obviously there was big news, but I'm assuming that's what a lot of the talk was yesterday on the show.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We had Nando Vila, it was great. We also talked about anti-vax semen.
Huh.
Which is apparently a thing that—
Has it just not been convinced yet?
Yeah, it's just very shy, very shy.
Mm-hmm. It's hesitant semen.
Yeah, no, you know, it was a fun show. So listen to the Bituation Room on YouTube at Franny Fio or wherever your podcast. Thanks, Joe.
And I heard that you can now show your support for the show. How can
you're
you
so
that?
Sweet. Yeah, bituationroom.com. You can get your Frantifa shirts, which is the squad that listens, and Bituation Room tote bags, all union made. I made sure, spared no expense.
Nice. That's awesome. Okay, with that, we are gonna take a break. When we come back, we're gonna be looking at another devastated part of the world. This time, we're gonna be going to Haiti. So we're gonna take a few, but we'll be back in just a sec. Okay, it is time to jump to very different news. No later though, hold on to your butts. Let's do this. Haiti is in the wake of an absolutely devastating earthquake. The most recent reports, almost certainly tragically already out of date, had nearly 1,300 dead as a result of the earthquake. Jumping rapidly from the 724 that had been previously reported. 1,297 is the current number. More than 5,700 have been injured. And of course, as is always the case in incidents like this, survivors are still being looked for. And you often have a breakdown of not only health services, but communication as well. And so we will see what it ends up being. But I want to give you a look at what it looked like after the earthquake. So here's a bit of that footage.
Okay. Parce que caisse a tombé net. Nous avons la caisse a tombé net. Okay. Caisse a tombé net. Okay, ça soit rapidement. Okay, caisse, nous avons la brûlée. Okay. Je savais sur une moto là. Ok. En pile moon frappé là, c'est le putain de la veille.
So you can see, absolutely devastating. The earthquake struck the southwestern part of the poor nation, almost completely destroying some towns, triggering landslides that also made it difficult for emergency services to get to the areas where they were needed. And for recent context, of course, the earthquake is hitting Haiti when it's already dealing with the ongoing pandemic, the recent presidential assassination, and a wave of gang violence. And by the way, a tropical storm Grace is expected to hit the nation either tonight or early tomorrow. At a time when, again, they're not only scrambling to try to save those who can be saved, but some of their ability to do so has been compromised as a result of the earthquake. And reports say that a number of people obviously have lost their homes as a result of this, but others are worried that the buildings that remain standing might be compromised structurally And so they've been sleeping in the streets for fear that the house or the building could fall apart at any moment. So Francesca, different sorts of tragedies, different parts of the world, absolutely devastating how much damage can be done by an earthquake 78 miles away.
No, and Haiti has been through so much. So my heart goes out to the Haitian people and my condolences. And I do feel like once again, as we've called for on this show, that the United States can do its part by not deporting Haitian immigrants so systematically and so cruelly back to a country that is unsafe for so many reasons. And then the other thing I was gonna say is, look, you know, we live in California, we get earthquakes. Obviously a 7.2 earthquake is a major event and has the capacity to hurt and kill people. However, when you live in an earthquake prone area in the so-called first world, there is something called preparedness. There are homes that are outfitted and buildings that are outfitted to withstand earthquakes. And after the amount of money that has been poured into Haiti, you know, from previous earthquakes, from previous, you know, attempts to set up, you know, export processing zones so we can get free trade, you know, Victoria's Secret and Hanes underwear and all kinds of, you know, like setting it up as this kind of sweatshop nation, that none of that money has gone to actually helping a country that is regularly hit by earthquakes, that none of that money has gone into helping those buildings and those homes be retrofitted to withstand earthquakes, right? And that seems to have not have been a concern by the international community, or let alone any of the leaders of Haiti. And so it is striking that, you know, you look at this and you're like, oh, I guess it's just a tragedy, you know, it's a global South country, and it doesn't have to be that way. Doesn't have to mean a death sentence for, you know, thousands of people to have a 7-point earthquake. It just exposes where the money has gone and where it hasn't.
No, that's a great point. I mean, you know, like I'm trying to come up with a natural disaster whose effects can be better mitigated than an earthquake. Like building regulations obviously are huge. Like, you know, California, as you alluded to, is evidence of that. They used to be far more devastating in terms of loss of life. We'll see if maybe this most recent round will change the prioritization for that. I don't know. I am reading from the AP that they've done a partial survey of the damage from the earthquake. And just the partial survey found 860 destroyed homes, more than 700 others were damaged, including hospitals, schools, offices, and churches. So we'll see. I mean, obviously right now the focus is on trying to save people who might be under rubble, those who have been made homeless by this. The prime minister has declared a 1-month state of emergency, and I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, charity that's organizing around this. We'll see, you know, how successful they are in getting aid to the people who need it. But obviously long term, with the regularity that earthquakes and other, you know, like tropical storms, things like that are hitting, building codes and regulations are obviously very necessary to be looked at. Any final thoughts?
No, only that the international community has failed Haiti time and again, and it does feel like Afghanistan, except it's not in the Middle East, right? And if it were in the Middle East, maybe there would be even more money there because, you know, strategic interests and whatnot. But, you know, how can we support the Haitian people themselves to have sovereignty and autonomy and democracy from the ground up and not imposed from corporations or from, you know, foreign entities? And you know, it's like, it's just, I'm at a loss, you know, this long into it. Like the international community has a responsibility, and it also has a responsibility to step away.
Yeah. Okay, we are running out of time in this first hour, but I believe we can fit in one more story. So let's actually, you know, I'm gonna remind people of one or two things right before we do that. I apologize for not letting you know. I know everyone's eagerly anticipating who is going to be joining Dr. Rashad Ritchie on Indisputable this morning. Well, Dina Dahl will be the co-host. The first time that I remember, it's possible that Dina has been on before, but she'll be joining. Dr. Rashad Ritchie on Indisputable coming up right after this program, available both on Twitch and at youtube.com/IndisputableTYT. Also want to let you know that today is the first day post multicast. So normally the Young Turks live show would stream on the Damage Report on YouTube. That has now ended, at the very least for now. So you can continue to watch it. You don't need to be a subscriber or a member or anything like that, but you will have to go to youtube.com/TheYoungTurks. You can subscribe, and if you want, you can ring the bell to get some small percentage of the notifications. Damn you, YouTube. But anyway, yeah, that's what? Your best bet.
It never notifies
there's
me.
There's nothing you can do to guarantee you'll get the notifications. It makes me so mad. But anyway, that is where it'll be available. And again, you do not need to be a member, whether to the network or to the show. You don't have to do anything. It's freely available at that channel. Now, that said, let's jump into a quick update to a story that we talked about last week. On Friday's edition of the Damage Report, my garbage person of the week was Tucker Carlson, for a very good reason. He, as predicted, attacked Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for her vulnerability and willingness to talk about her fears of sexual violence during the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. In talking about that, he aired a clip of AOC's conversation with Dana Bash, commenting that the Congresswoman should get a therapist, saying, "This is crazy." He also called her honey, and as you'll see from this screenshot, used a photo of her designed to leave his audience with the impression that either women are crazy, or maybe women of color specifically are crazy, but look at her eyes in this photo. Anyway, the representative has responded to his attack, saying, "I couldn't care less about what this talking inferiority complex has to say, but I do feel for the women and survivors in his life who now see they wouldn't be believed or safe with him. Many survivors of assault don't tell family, friends, etc., because of how they see others treated." And that is, you know, characteristically a mature response to an incredibly misogynistic and underhanded, needless attack from one of the regrettably most watched faces in cable news. Francesca, I don't know if you had originally seen what he said on, I believe it was his Thursday show, but what do you make of this back and forth?
I mean, we talked about this a week ago, and we knew that the right was gonna come and mock AOC, a sexual assault survivor herself, someone who has had memes depicted of her being raped, who her rape is discussed online regularly. I'm sure she's gotten threats. That we knew that because they don't care, they don't have any, they see her as the enemy somehow. She's got superpowers beyond their comprehension somehow. That they were gonna go after her, and now we see that they did. They completely went after her, and it was nice to see her making it kind of about more broadly. Look at what happens when you're honest about your fears around sexual violence. This is what happens. The most watched show in the country mocks you. And then the other thing was, why was he referring to her as Sandy the whole time?
I mean, why, if you had to guess, why is he referring to her as Sandy?
I don't know, just like that this is now his like nickname for her.
It's just demeaning. I don't think it's specifically demeaning for any particular, like I don't think it's a reference to anything really. I think it's just, you don't need to refer to her by her chosen name or as representative or whatever. Just call her whatever you want, call her Sandy. It sounds like a girl's thing. We're gonna treat her like she's a little girl, a little Sandy. I think that's what it's about.
No, I mean, I think that was the grossest part about it. It was that he kept on being like, "Sandy says Sandy." And it's like, what did, I was like, did she go by this at any point in her life? No, he's just, yeah, no, he's speaking down to her. You're right, making her sound like a little girl. Look, what do you expect? He's a garbage monster. Yes, he's fills your little cute trash can way too often, and that trash can does not deserve that.
That's true. It spit it out actually later on. Okay. Well, in any event, that is all the time we have in our first hour for those of you watching us on our linear platform. Thank you for watching. There is more news that we have to get to though, so we are going to be talking about children, the new trend in hospitalization for COVID, an absolute tragedy. We're gonna break that down, give you a response from a terrible Republican governor. All that and more. We're gonna take a short break, but stick around. We'll be back after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.